You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Barbara Ferrer is the most powerful person at Target, Ralph's, LAX, and the DMV. LA's public health director gets to decide whether you can show your full face inside or not. Well, unless you've already decided that for yourself. So the question is, will she or won't she implement another indoor mask mandate in LA County? Long Beach and Pasadena have their own health departments. They say they will not implement a mandate. A few other cities, Beverly Hills, Manhattan Beach, El Segundo, they say they won't enforce it either if there is one. So, Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer, what's it going to be?
Given the declines in case and hospitalization numbers, we're hopeful that the admission rate over the next few days remains under 10 new admissions per 100,000 residents, and LA County is soon officially moved by CDC to the medium community level. As I noted last week, any indication that the county would soon be moving to the medium community level would be a good reason to not move forward with universal indoor masking, which is what we are doing today. We will be pausing and not moving forward at this time.
So there you go. No indoor mask mandate for now. And hopefully a continuation of the number of cases and hospitalizations trending down. All of this, of course, is based on testing data. How many people are testing positive for the virus, as well as how many people are being hospitalized. But with so many folks using at-home tests, you know, the ones you got in the mail, and not reporting results to the county, is there really any way to know how much virus is in the community? Well, actually, there is a way. Ah, you know that sound. And you know what? It's got something to do with tracking COVID. See, after you use the facilities, waste flows down into the sewer pipes under your home, initiating a hidden journey deep beneath the city. If you live in South Los Angeles, your waste flows through bigger and bigger pipes until it ends up here. As a torrent of sewage rushing into a wastewater treatment plant in Carson. Well, every day, supervising scientist Carla Ellison and her team collect several jugs of brown, muckish sewage.
Am I smelling what I think I'm smelling?
Absolutely.
And they test that muck for the coronavirus. And then data about how much of the virus is concentrated in the sewage gets passed on to the county's public health department. And they can use that to see trends in the spread of the virus. KCRW's Robin Estrin recently visited the Carson sewage plant, and she's with us right now. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Steve.
So you really got the bomb story, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you saw scientists in Carson collecting feces, right? For coronavirus testing.
I did, Steve, and I smelled it too. They're actually storing samples of our sewage in what's essentially a giant plastic jug in a refrigerator and then sending it out for testing. And this is useful because we store the virus in our gastrointestinal tracts when we're sick, and we release it into the sewer when we use the bathroom. Scientists here in LA County started testing our wastewater for the virus back in 2020, and public health officials have been analyzing that data as part of their early alert system. It actually helps tell them where we're headed with the virus.
So we heard today Dr. Ferrer say that hospitalizations are on the decline, right? Is she seeing that trend in the wastewater data too?
Well, the wastewater data is certainly part of Dr. Ferrer's calculus. At her news conference, Dr. Ferrer pulled up the latest wastewater data from our two largest water treatment plants, as she does every week, and said the concentration of the virus in our sewage has plateaued at the Hyperion plant, which captures waste from millions of people in the city of LA. And then she shared data from the Carson facility, where the amount of virus in the sewage has actually started to decrease. This is important because wastewater data, as we know, is a leading indicator. Dr. Prabhu Gounder, the physician who oversees all wastewater surveillance at the LA County Department of Public Health, says that if that decline remains consistent, we might see the number of people hospitalized continue to decline in the coming weeks as well.
Data about COVID in the wastewater can also help predict hospitalizations. Is that right?
That's almost right. I mean, this data is not a fortune teller, but it is pretty good at reflecting what's happening in our community right now. Throughout the pandemic, there's actually been this really clear correlation between spikes in the concentration of coronavirus in our sewage and spikes in hospitalizations. Here's Dr. Ferrer.
When you start seeing higher concentration levels in the wastewater, you should anticipate that shortly after, you are going to see increases in hospitalizations, because that trend has followed consistently.
And the same is true when times are good, right? Downward trends of the virus in the sewage system mean a downward trend in hospitalizations. But that said, Ferrer calls wastewater data a crude measurement.
It doesn't exactly tell you who is infected, but it obviously gives you a sense in given communities what that level of infection may be. And in particular, what we use it for is to establish trends.
So it's really, it's a broad look, right, at what's going on, sort of a snapshot in time in a given community. And it sounds like it's good to have this data, Robin, given how little we know about who's testing positive for COVID these days, right?
That's true. There are about as many people reporting test results now as there were in July of 2020, back when we were just beginning to resolve major testing supply shortages and backlogs. Plus, a lot of people carrying the COVID-19 virus aren't testing at all because they just don't have symptoms. Wastewater testing, on the other hand, is an early indicator. Health officials can look at the data and tell when there might be a lot of sick people in our community, even when those people don't know about it. That said, it's cool, but there are a lot of things the wastewater testing cannot tell us.
Cannot tell us? Like what?
Well, the data doesn't capture everyone's waste. In some parts of the county, like in Malibu and rural parts of the valley, people's sewage pipes lead to septic tanks in some cases. And there's also this bigger issue. There's a lot of different ways of testing wastewater. Nayoko Munakata explained this to me. She's the wastewater supervisor at the LA County Sanitation District.
When this started, everyone was kind of just rushed out to try and figure out how to do this and was kind of doing their own thing. And as a result, people developed a lot of different methods. So there are a lot of methods out there for looking at SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater. There's no standardized method.
That prevents scientists from being able to combine data that's coming in from all these different wastewater plants across the county into a single number. So health officials can only use this data to talk about trends, like Dr. Ferrer said, whether the amount of virus in our community is going up or going down.
There's that word again, broad, right? Broad, just a snapshot in the broader community. But before you get out of here, Robin, I'm wondering if scientists can test for coronavirus in sewage, can't they test for other viruses as well?
Yeah, they can test for all sorts of things, even influenza. But those tests are really only useful if there's a relatively high amount of virus spreading through a community. And like COVID-19, we shed that virus through our GI tract. Like, let's take monkeypox, for example.
Okay.
The county health department hasn't taken on monkeypox testing across the county because there's not enough of the virus in our community to register in our wastewater yet.
There are like 200 some odd cases, right? As opposed to millions of cases of COVID.
Right. So here's Dr. Gounder with LA County.
If transmission continues and monkeypox cases continue to grow, I worry that we may get to a point where wastewater surveillance will be useful.
The good news is we now have the technology in our biggest water treatment facilities that does allow us to observe this virus and the next one. And I don't think that would be true if it weren't for the shock the pandemic sent through our healthcare system.
It wasn't the cleanest story that you've ever done, Robin.
Possibly the filthiest.
Probably the filthiest story. But thank you for doing it. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve.
KCRW's Robin Estrin. All right, straight ahead, photographers looking at Black American life, particularly in the turbulent 60s, what those pictures say about the times and how we're looking at those pictures today. That's yours when GLA continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with even more of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In 1963, a group of black photographers and friends in New York City came together to form a collective. Tired of not seeing themselves represented in mainstream media, they decided to create their own representation, documenting black life in the 20th century from the everyday to the extraordinary. They called themselves the Kamoenge Workshop, and today that collective is getting their first major exhibition at the Getty Center. And with me to talk about this exhibit is photographer and founding member of the Kamoenge Workshop, Anthony Barboza, and the Getty curator, Maisie Harris. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yay. Thank you.
Anthony, I mentioned at the top that you wanted to create your own representation, right? I mean, I'm thinking 1963. It was a tumultuous time in American history, the Civil Rights Movement, the 16th Street Baptist Church bomb, so many things were happening at that time. Tell us a little bit more about why and how your group came together.
Now, I went to New York City when I was 19, and Adja Collins brought me to the group that was just starting. So I was sort of overwhelmed. Because my family, there's eight boys, and I'm the oldest, so I never had older brothers. So when I got to Kamoenge, I was the youngest one, and I was overwhelmed by everything I learned just like that by sitting at the meetings, especially when they discussed a photograph. One of the members would put up a photograph, and they would dissect it and say that whether they liked it or not, or if they had more to say about it, they would say it. And I learned so much by just sitting there and listening to all this. So it was wonderful, you know, to be in this group. And that's how I learned. We not only talked about music and art, but we talked about photography. And sometimes Jim Brown running for a touchdown. So yeah, that was all a learning experience to me.
You did photograph some truly remarkable folks, though, over the years. One of the images that I'm most struck with is Easter. You know,
right.
Easter, right? It's a photo of these are three
right.
young boys mm-hmm. in their Sunday best, right? Three-piece suits and hats, you know, the whole nine yards, posing
right.
in front of a graffiti-covered brick wall. Tell us how this one came about and what you were trying to say with that.
I was walking in Harlem, and my idea was that I wanted to start by showing the positiveness and the beauty of us. And I shot a lot more photos that day, but that's the one I chose.
Man, they are smiling
suits.
Ear to ear, each one of them.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, you know, it's not so much that I would just run in and take the photograph. I tried to talk to them, you know. I was feeling them and they're feeling me, so I wanted to get something from them and not to be so stiff, but they were in their own groove. And together, I always say that the photograph finds you. You don't find the photograph. So your patience is always important in that sense.
What strikes me, Anthony, about this picture is the fact that you can almost envision what they were doing before and after that picture was taken.
Right.
And they are smiling. They are happy. You know it's their Sunday best. It is a really cool picture, and it shows, because of those smiles, it shows, you know, a jubilation.
Yeah.
That I think is really pointed. Maisie, I want to bring you in because this show, as I mentioned, is striking and unlike what I think many folks expect of the Getty. Like, this is something a little different, right?
Yeah, it's really wonderful for us to get to have this exhibition. It was organized by the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, and we're so happy to get to have it on the West Coast. I think that photo that you're talking about so wonderfully captures Tony's ability to capture the pattern of everyday life. I think photographers give us this ability to pay attention to things we might otherwise overlook, and that show certainly does this.
It's so cool, these pictures. And our producer, Juliana Mayo, went down to the Getty to check not only some of them out, but also to see what other people, you know, the reactions of other people there. And she caught up with a woman who was just looking around, a lady named Dolores McDavid, who was taking a look at the show. And this is what she had to say about what she was looking at.
I did not know about the exhibit until I arrived at the Getty Center. Oh, wow. Did not hear about it, did not know about it. Came across this one. Blew my mind. What I see here represents me.
I wonder, Maisie, I mean, again, if you're talking about making a connection, this woman who was there just happened to be at the Getty, right?
Wow.
And is looking at these pictures, and she is enamored with them, and it, you know, she says they speak to her.
Oh, that's beautiful. I think it's so wonderful to hear that. I think that's what we hope for when we go to museums, right? To find connection. And I think this work really does that. There's such a variety of work. There's community work. There's civil rights work. There's work about jazz. There's work about global travels. There's really incredible abstractions. So I really think there's something for everyone in this exhibition.
Anthony, some of the folks that you see on the walls of this show are so remarkable. I mean, there's Malcolm X, and there's Mahalia Jackson, and there's Miles Davis. There's a portrait you made of Grace Jones that I think looks unlike anything that I've ever seen of her. Having seen her at the Hollywood Bowl a few times, you know, it's like, wait, that's Grace Jones. It's kind of an extreme close-up and just very soft and beautiful. I mean, not kind of like the angular, fierce image that she's known for. Tell us about that picture of Grace Jones. How did you meet her, and how did this portrait come to be?
Okay, what happened was that, okay, when Grace Jones first came to New York, she wanted to be a model. But nobody would take any photographs of her. She went around to photographers. She wasn't at that time singing at all. So I took a liking to her, and I did that photograph. And then later, I gave her her first job for Essence Magazine with the Chambers Brothers.
You were shooting for Essence Magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah, that photo, the Grace Jones photo, is great because you, that's, you know, you were promoting her career, and that photo really catapulted your career as well. That was, you were both sort of young,
right?
Just trying to make it, and
yeah,
that photo did a lot for both of you.
Yeah, it's a close-up photo of her face, and it's remarkable. It's beautiful, and it's part of the collection at the Smithsonian, right?
Yeah, it's there, yeah.
You know, Anthony, there's a quote from one of your fellow photographers, Jimmy Manis, that stood out to me, and he said this. He said, the work was black. That made it political back then. That makes it political now. Ooh, that's a lot, right?
Politics is something that what you do and say really means a lot to people who are open-minded. Okay. But showing a photograph is sometimes better than talking. You can just look at it and feel something for yourself, as opposed to it gives you something back if you view it. There's lots of times a politician gets up there and you don't receive anything, even though he's talking like he's giving you something. But the political statement part of that, for me, has always been the beauty of us, and also to show how we as a people go about our daily lives. Then as you work into that through the years, and for the guidance of the Camonge brothers, we were able to, in some instances, hit that photograph that says something about racism and where we live. So that is what, that's the political side of it. The other side is like having a birthday party and you're there and everybody's feeling good. That's important.
It's a snapshot, too. Right? Snapshot in time.
So it's two different aspects of
it. Yeah, the uplift.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a lot of the work, or at least some of it, is quite abstract. I mean, you take pictures. You said, you know, anything from the everyday to the extraordinary. We talk Grace Jones and Diane Carroll and Malcolm X and all these other extraordinary
right.
people, but also close-ups of puddles and reflections, you know, and shadow self-portraits, you know, very modern, very existential. This is what's happening. This is what's before your eye right now at the moment. And it's just the everyday.
But it says something always. Let's take, for instance, there's a photograph that Alpinard did of a salt pile. And to me, that means this is the mountain to climb, that we have to climb every day in our lives. So it's another meaning behind that, because our consciousness, yeah, and we are dealing with something that when we're photographing, we get into another state of mind and our subconscious takes over and we are collecting all this information in our brains when we're conscious. But then when we photograph and we get into the conscious state, unconscious state of mind, I mean the subconscious, we start reflecting on different things and seeing visuals that explain a lot more. And it doesn't explain that much to the viewer unless we explain it to them. Some people might get it and some people don't. It's like you going to a museum. And I was always taught, people walk through a museum and look at a painting and they'll stand there for a long time and they go through each one. I always felt that the ones that attract you, you attract that one and you stand and look at that one. Not every single one. I got to find something in that painting that would do that. The same as photography. It's all the same.
It's like you said, you know, sometimes the shot finds you, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us. The pictures are so inspiring and compelling. Anthony Barboza and Maisie Harris from the Getty, thank you both for coming on to talk about it today.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And the exhibit is called Working Together, the Photographers of the Kamange Workshop. It's up now at the Getty through October 9th. More information at our website and some pictures, too, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. That's your snapshot in time for today. Next week, the importance and jubilation of the Bill Pickett Rodeo for Black Americans and Black Angelenos. And ayahuasca, a psychedelic spiritual experience in the Santa Monica Mountains. Who's there and why? What's going on? And a tour of Frank Lloyd Wright's Hollyhock House at Hollywood's Barnsdall Park. All yours next week on Greater LA. I hope you'll join us. Always online at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. What's on your mind? What would you like to hear on Greater LA? Is there a story? Sign up for the podcast, too, all at the website, kcrw.com/GLA, and get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's episode possible. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Joyous that you joined us this evening. Have a great night.